digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
Well, welcome to another Digging in the Dirt. I'm Kevin Gallagher, and my guest today is Rhonda Sherman, educator and author of a new book called The Worm Farmer's Handbook, Mid to Large-Scale Vermicomposting for Farms, Businesses, Municipalities, Schools, and Institutions, Techniques and Systems for Processing Food Scraps, Manure, Yard Debris, Paper, and More. And it's published by a great publishing company, Chelsea Green Publishing. Rhonda Sherman is the director of the Compost Learning Lab at North Carolina State University and one of the leading experts worldwide on vermicomposting. Rhonda travels extensively to present workshops and to consult with farmers, businesses, and institutions on the development and management of vermicomposting systems. She organizes the highly successful annual North Carolina State Vermiculture Conference, which for 19 years has drawn participants from across the United States and around the globe. Welcome, Rhonda. Welcome back to Digging in the Dirt.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In your new book, you delineate three sizes of vermicomposting. And the last time you were here with me, we were talking about basically the first size, a very small-scale vermicomposting that people might be doing in their basement or their backyard. But this one is particularly geared to mid-size or medium-size and large-scale earthworm operations. So could you tell me why you decided that it was key for you to key in on this Worm Farmer's Handbook?
Because there weren't books about mid to large scale vermicomposting. For a few decades, there have been books on, starting with Mary Abelhoff's Worms Eat My Garbage book, a few decades ago, that's been available, and it's a wonderful book about how to do small-scale vermicomposting so that you can do it at home with your kitchen scraps or do it in school classrooms. And there have been other good books since then about small-scale vermicomposting, but it was really lacking. There weren't books on mid to large scale. So somebody who has a farm who wants to vermicompost the organic waste on their farm, say it be animal manures or crop residues, or community gardens. I mean, that's just really expanded, that there are so many community gardens and school gardens and schools that want to vermicompost their lunchroom waste. So taking it instead of a small classroom bin to doing it, taking all the organic waste at the school. And then people want to get into it for the business of vermicomposting. So that was really needed. And, I've had 25 years of experience working with people throughout the world. I mean, people in 111 countries have contacted me because they want to get into large-scale vermicomposting or they're already doing it and they want to do it better. Just lots and lots of interest in this. And so my 25 years with vermicomposting, but also with composting, I've got extensive experience with that, and I wanted to combine the two into the book. I mean, the book focuses on vermicomposting, but I also emphasize the importance of pre-composting organic residues before vermicomposting. Mm-hmm. And then I talk about regulations. I talk about, business plans and marketing plans, which, sure, a lot of people are very eager to start raising worms, and they don't develop business plans in advance, and so then they run into problems. So I wanted to address all of those things in my book.
Well, I think you did. I just finished reading it, and it's really comprehensive and gives you a lot of good ways to go with this subject if you're interested in vermicomposting. Tell me, you're talking about vermicomposting and composting and pre-composting. Maybe we even briefly can separate those and talk about what they are. And then, is vermicomposting better than composting, or can we do one without the other?
It's a very good place to start. In fact, I'm giving a half day workshop on in 2 weeks at the U.S. Composting Council conference, and that's where composters, thermophilic composters, come from all over the world for this annual conference. And the title of my half-day workshop is Boost Profits for Your Composting Operation with Value-Added Products. And so I didn't put the word worm in there, but that's what it's all about. It's taking the compost that you produce and then giving it a boost by feeding it to worms, and it will be worth a lot more because, yes, there is a difference. So thermophilic composting, that's the traditional composting that, you know, has been taking place for, you know, for hundreds of years, but basically combining organic materials in the right carbon to nitrogen ratios and a number of other factors as well. But anyway, combining them so that microorganisms will start to break down those organic materials, and it causes the temperature of the pile to rise. And so it gets into, you know, like over 130, 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's a really valuable thing to do, and it transforms the what's considered waste into a valuable product, which is compost. And compost here in the United States can be sold for about $30 or $35 per cubic yard, and it's a really great thing, and I'm a big supporter of the composting industry. It's just that there have been a lot of scientific studies comparing the effect of on plants of compost and vermicompost, and the vermicompost just does a better job. It has a greater effect on plants. And so so you can sell vermicompost for a minimum of $200 per cubic yard and up to $1,800 per cubic yard.
Wow.
So that's a big difference.
Sure is.
Selling compost for $30 or $35 and then selling vermicompost for, say, $700 per cubic yard. So the same amount, but you can sell it for a whole lot more.
And is that the reason? Is it because it's more bacterial content and it's also got more micronutrients and stuff because the worms are breaking everything down for the plants?
Yes. Composting and vermicomposting are two totally different processes. And I'm glad you raised this issue because there's a lot of confusion, and people use the terms people will contact me and vermicomposting might be in the subject line, and then they may or may not say something about, you know, I want to learn more about vermicomposting, but then throughout the rest of the email, they keep saying composting, and I'm scratching my head. Well, do you want to hear about composting or vermicomposting? You know, let's be clear about this. So I already described what composting is about. Basically, you know, it's the microorganisms that are breaking down the materials, and as those temperatures rise, it actually changes the microbial population because microorganisms that tolerate the lower temperatures won't tolerate those higher temperatures. And so many of those will just go dormant, and others will emerge during that process. So there's a big change in the microbial population during the composting process, whereas with vermicomposting, we refer to it as cold composting because you want the temperature to stay about the same, okay, throughout the process, and you want it to be low. You want it, I mean, much lower than thermophilic composting.
Because you'll kill the worms.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you get above 85 degrees in a lot of places, and the worms are going to be slowing down, and depending on the conditions, they could die, you know, when it hits 95 or so. So you want to keep it lower. And the beauty of that is that, you're only dealing with mesophilic microorganisms, and so you just have huge numbers and huge varieties and species of microorganisms throughout this process. So you and then the worm, so microorganisms are breaking down the materials, and then the worms are ingesting the microorganisms, and they already have microbes in their guts. And so I call earthworms microbe factories, because what they take in and what comes out the other end is much greater.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the idea du jour these days, that the soil has become a lot more devoid of this stuff because of all our chemical processes and the modern processes of farming, and that we want to build up the soil. So vermicomposting is a really good way to do that. Am I right?
Yes, exactly.
Better than regular composting.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you would still want to compost. It's sort of like from doing all these interviews and talking to people, it seems like we're all sort of decomposers in one way or the other.
Yes.
And the worms are a really good decomposer.
They are. Yeah. And so, you know, the difference in the products is that, I mean, microorganisms were involved with both composting and vermicomposting, but obviously you have different species of microorganisms involved in the vermicomposting process. Plus, the material is going into, it's passing through an animal, an earthworm. And so, you know, it's coming out the other end of that animal, and that makes it a very different product from compost. You know, with composting, people try to rush Mother Nature and cut corners and produce compost more quickly, and you can't do that because compost has to cure. You have to reach those high temperatures, and then, you know, it's required by state and federal laws, and then the temperatures have to come down, and then the material needs time to stabilize, and it enhances the material in many ways. So it's really important to cure the compost for a few months before you apply it. Whereas vermicompost, it can come out the end of a worm and it's stable.
And it's actually kind of quicker, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yes. So vermicomposting is quicker than compost, and then composting, and then you get this stable product.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, last time we talked, I told you I have a small worm farm, which is doing just fine all by itself, basically. I just keep feeding the worms, and everything's good, and I keep taking out the black gold on the other side, so I'm very happy. It's an easy... Yeah, it's a real easy process for, you know, the small scale. Now we're talking bigger scale, which adds a whole bunch of other problems. But we were just talking about the soil, you know, and maybe you could, from your perch, tell us what you see as if there is a soil problem and why vermicomposting is helping the situation.
Well, I did talk about that in the book. I talked about how globally the soils have been depleted. And this is one reason why I'm hearing from people from all over the world, because they see that they have an organic waste problem, and they also see that they have depleted soils. And so they're putting that together and saying, hey, vermicompost could solve both of these problems. And so I'm really glad to see that it's taking place.
Now, and so maybe you could tell us how much of a problem is the fact that we have a lot of organic waste, a lot of organic matter that's just being thrown away?
Oh, huge problems. And it's frustrating that people that we don't talk about it. Kids don't learn about it in school. I guess they're learning about it a little more. They certainly didn't talk about it when I was going to school. But people don't realize how harmful landfills are. And I say this saying that, you know, I mean, we do need landfills. I'm not saying that we need zero landfills. A community should have the goal of zero waste. And therefore not needing landfills. But we have a ways to go with that. So I'm not saying let's abolish landfills today. But we really have to stop this mentality of making these single-use things, you know, using all sorts of resources to create single-use items that just get used briefly and thrown away. And people are like, you know, away, you know, away is out of sight, out of mind. And they don't realize where it goes. And so by going to landfills, they would realize if a landfill was proposed in their neighborhood. That would help wake them up, and they'd realize that, hey, I don't want a landfill here. Well, where do landfills end up? They end up either long distances away, so there's a huge carbon footprint to carry items to the landfill, or they end up traditionally in low-income minority neighborhoods,
right,
which is horrible and so unfair. But so what's wrong with landfills? Well, landfills leak. They leak out of the bottom and out of the top. And so we used to have dumps where people would just, you know, find a ravine and dump stuff in. And then this is actually how I first got started in the solid waste management business, was back in 1980. I was hired to make the correlation between landfills and water wells that were contaminated. They were just starting to realize, oh my gosh, these dumps are leaking and it's contaminating people's water. And so that was really alarming. And so, you know, in the 80s, they started developing plans and standards for sanitary landfills. And those were adopted in the late 80s. And the idea was to try to prevent these air and water emissions. But admittedly, you know, the EPA said, yeah, it's not foolproof. So, you know, if people could see the liners that are in the bottom of landfills, they'd be horrified.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so thin. And there are so many ways that they can tear or be installed inaccurately. And so eventually landfills will have liquid emissions out of the bottom. Okay.
And part of the thing that we're talking about, the emissions from the air, that we're talking basically methane from all the organic matter.
Yeah, we're talking methane, yes. And so there are pipes that collect the methane, because methane likes to travel horizontally. And so they were having a problem with methane traveling horizontally, say a mile away, and blowing up next to an elementary school. And so they said, this isn't cool. I guess we need to try to channel the methane so into these pipes. But the problem is they're not required to do anything with the methane. So a lot of landfills just flare it off. So it just goes straight into the atmosphere. And we know that methane is a huge contributor to climate change. And what people don't realize is that landfills is one of the greatest contributors to methane. Yeah, so it's really bad. And even the landfills that do a really good job of capturing the methane and, say, use the methane to turn a turbine at a nearby industry, the methane in a lot of it inevitably leaks out anyway. They can't have 100% capture of methane.
And so this brings us back to the organic matter waste. Okay, so like I see what I'm throwing into my little tiny worm farm in the basement, and it's astounding. I didn't even use it all. You know, I put it into the compost bin too, but I'm not using enough of it. And I'm wondering, how much of the organic waste the Americans are throwing out? I mean, is it?
It's like 40%.
40% of all organic waste. So all your cucumber peels and your tomatoes and rottenness and that are all just being thrown away.
Yes.
And then the municipality, correct me if I'm wrong, has to now get rid of it in some way, and that costs them money to do it.
Yes.
And then why, my question is, wouldn't they want to have worms get rid of it and then sell the byproduct to make money?
Well, thank goodness, within the past decade, cities are realizing, wow, we've been concentrating on recycling cans, paper, and bottles, but we overlooked the organic fraction of the waste stream. And so, they actually realized in the early 90s that they needed to keep yard waste out of landfills. So, for example, North Carolina, 1993, they banned yard waste from landfills, from regular sanitary landfills. Unfortunately, they didn't say you have to compost it, so some people just put it in a different hole in the ground. But but many states throughout the United States have adopted yard waste bans. But handling food waste is more complicated. So, you know, because food waste is mostly water and it breaks down very quickly. And since it is so high in water, that means it's going to get stinky. And so it's a little harder to manage, you know, for people to collect it and then for even trucks to come around and collect it, because you have to have a special type of truck. Otherwise, with all that liquid from decomposing food, you would have trails of stinky liquid going through the city from leaking out of the truck.
I see.
And so, you know, it takes a little more effort to recycle food waste, but more than 120 cities are throughout the United States are doing it. And I like to point to San Francisco, because you know how we all started out with just a garbage can, right? And then we went to garbage carts, and then we went to recycling carts too. So most of us living in cities are putting out at least a garbage cart and a recycling cart. And then if yard waste is collected separately because of the landfill ban, then you also put out a yard waste cart. And, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Now, with San Francisco, they said, we can add food waste to the yard waste cart. So they have three bins, just like the people here in Raleigh have.
Cool.
I just want to give them extra credit for, you know, like any small... any municipality that says, oh, it can't be done, it's too hard, I point to San Francisco and I say, look at this enormous city that probably has more diverse populations than most cities in this country. And so, like around here, if you want to make a sign, you might make it in English and Spanish. In San Francisco, I forget how many languages they have to put it in, something 8 or 18 or something.
America.
Because, you know, so if a huge city with so many people and non-English speaking people can manage to compost their food waste, then I think everybody else could be doing it too, you know?
I think you're right.
But why even do that? Why rely on the city to pick up your food waste? Because guess what? Take special trucks. The trucks break down. They need maintenance. Those trucks are expensive. You have to pay labor to you know, drive those trucks around, look at the carbon footprint, all the gas and fuel, everything being used. And then you have to take it somewhere, and you know, so that costs money too, to have it composted. And so that's why I really advocate for people just to do it at home. You know, if you live in an apartment, get a worm bin. If you have, you know, if you live in a house and you have a yard, then have a compost bin and a yard and a worm bin. There's no reason to be throwing food waste away.
And you got to limit what single-use plastics and everything you're using.
Exactly. Yeah.
We have to make some big changes,
right? So I'm trying to totally eliminate that, and you know, once in a while it does creep into one's household, you know. So, but my point is that it's the organic stuff that's getting stinky. And so while we're on the topic of stinky organics, if you're collecting food waste, and, you know, people might think, oh, she's like this famous composter and vermicomposter. Well, I'm just as busy and lazy or whatever as you, as anybody else. Okay. So it takes me a week or two to make it to the compost bin. And so instead of having food waste rotting in a container on my counter for a week or two, which with a lid is no big deal, you're not going to smell it. But when you do open the lid, you'll smell odors and there might be some bio slime on the side of the container. I don't do that anymore. I put my food waste and my other organics into my freezer, my refrigerator freezer.
Mm-hmm.
So I just have two shoebox size containers in there, and that's where my laundry lint and all my food waste and everything just goes in there.
Cool. That's a good idea.
Yeah, because then it doesn't smell at all, and you don't need a lid. You just pop open the freezer and dump it in and, you know, go.
And one thing I do is I run it through the food processor real quick to make it start its decomposing.
See, you take more effort than I do.
I just find it easy, and it's easier for the worms to consume it.
It is. And, you know, it's definitely a great thing to do. But for me, then I'm like, I have to clean out the food processor. So, you know, I don't take that extra step.
We're speaking to Rhonda Sherman. She's written, first of all, I should say that she's probably forgotten more about this subject than we've ever known. But she has a new book out called The Worm Farmer's Handbook, Mid to Large Scale Vermicomposting for Farms, Businesses, Municipalities, Schools, and Institutions. And I'll tell you, it's a very comprehensive book. If you have any desire at all to learn anything about worms and start doing even small scale, or if you have a large garden or a small farm, this is a really great book for you to have, because it also will keep you in line about business plans and all that kind of stuff that nobody likes to do. Rhonda, your book has a lot of different categories. I want to go through a couple of them. I want to give it its due. She has chapters on choosing the right production system, regulatory issues and developing a business and marketing plan, finding and managing feedstocks, pre-composting, why you want to do it, how you do it, monitoring an active worm bed, harvesting, screening, testing, packaging, and storing vermicast, markets for earthworms and vermicast, food security, how vermicast benefits soils and plants, and keys to success, avoiding common pitfalls. So you can see it's quite comprehensive, this book called The Worm Farmer's Handbook. So we have time for one more of these subjects. Which one would you like to hit on to just let the audience know what's going on with vermicomposting?
Oh, wow. Out of all those?
Out of all those, right. Just let's pick one here.
Well, I do want to emphasize the importance of earthworm husbandry, because so many people contact me and they're excited about getting started with vermicomposting and they think it's all about the bin. I mean, their questions, you would think they're talking about machines, and it's like, I'm sorry, we're dealing with animals, you know? So anyway, that's the most important thing to emphasize, because people just tend to rush into it. They think they know about earthworms, and there's so much more that needs to be understood before embarking on buying earthworms. You should start with a pound. A pound of earthworms costs, it's about $1,000, and you need Eisenia foetida. So it's, you know, I only talked about one species of earthworm in the book because it's really been proven to work the best for people worldwide. So,
red wigglers.
Getting that, they're commonly known as red wigglers, or, you know, I've been to developing countries and they're like, yeah, we need to get some of those California red worms. They're Eisenia foetida. They're all the same. You know, they're going to have different common names. But anyway, I'll tell my audiences, when you leave here, are you, you know, how about just stopping by and picking up a cow and taking it home with you? And, you know, they look at me like, you know, are you crazy? why would I buy a cow? And it's because they're thinking, where would I put it? What would I feed it? How would I take care of a cow? I don't know anything about raising cows. I can't. That's such a rash decision to just buy a cow with no, not doing any homework or preparation for it. And I say, well, you know, earthworms are animals too. Why would you just pick up a pound of earthworms on the way home and not have a habitat prepared for them, and not know what to feed them and care for them? So earthworm husbandry is really the most important thing. And so I discuss that in detail in the book.
Yeah, because they are living things. Some of my guests have said they'd like to take care of their underground livestock. I always like that.
There you go. Because they are livestock. They are livestock. So you really have to approach it like you would, you know, getting chickens or goats or cows or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're livestock, they're animals, and your whole production system is going to depend on how well and carefully you raise them. It's not about the machine that you put them in.
Mm-hmm. So the last thing I want to talk about is, give me a case study. I mean, I know you have a couple of them. There's a worm farm in Durham, and there's also this other one, Noki LTD, which has billions of earthworms. So which one do you want to talk about? Because this is fascinating to me that one place could have 62 acres of worms.
Well, that's just it. You know, you said a couple. I actually gave over 24 profiles in the book.
Yeah, you did.
Of vermicomposting operations of varying sizes, and they are from around the world. So, for example, I'm in touch with the only woman-owned vermicomposting operation in Afghanistan. And so, of course, for them, for their machinery, they're using concrete blocks. But I also, when you said Durham, that's Durham, California, and that's a 40-acre ranch. And they're millionaires because of vermicomposting. They started with vermicomposting, and they changed their business plan and operations according to customer demand, and it made them rich.
Everybody loves it.
You were talking about Noak Limited. That's in New Zealand. And so they have, you know, massive vermicomposting and composting operations in New Zealand, and also south of the border in Mexico. There is a dentist who has started over 70 composting and vermicomposting operations, often combining the two, and their smallest operation is larger than anything we have in the United States.
Hmm.
Kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing. Do you think that the municipalities, I mean, big stuff in the United States is going to embrace this? Do you think from your where you sit, because you're teaching all this and seeing all these people, are there municipalities, cities, and towns going to make the switch and start doing this kind of stuff?
Well, I've often talked them out of it. You know, people hear my enthusiasm for vermicomposting and they think, yeah, this is what we want to do. And, you know, you really have to have the right circumstances. So oftentimes I will steer people to composting rather than vermicomposting. Mm-hmm. And especially with really huge volumes, you know, in Mexico and in California, they have a milder climate, so they can do vermicomposting on a really large scale outdoors. But, you know, in northeastern United States or even here in the southeast, we have wide temperature swings, and it's going to be really hard for the earthworms to survive and thrive. So I know how to keep earthworms alive, but if I were doing production, commercial production, where I wanted to get an income, I would not be using my worm barn, because it's one thing to keep the worms alive, and it's another to have them thrive all the time, no matter what the temperature is.
Hmm, and, interesting.
You know, be able to keep going. So the problem with municipalities is that they would have to have a very large indoor space for most of them, unless they were in a mild climate.
Well, we sure have a problem with waste, that's for sure.
That's for sure. And frankly, larger quantities of waste can be more efficiently composted than vermicomposted. And that's one of the many reasons why I recommend that people pre-compost before they feed it to the worms. And that is, you know, that volume can be reduced by about half by pre-composting.
Hmm. And so you like the idea.
That's one of many reasons why I would recommend pre-composting.
Hmm. And you also like the idea of all of us getting involved and doing it individually on a smaller scale.
Yes, definitely.
Hmm. Makes sense.
Definitely. Yeah, it's not that hard.
Right.
And that's why I have publications on my website. I've got Worms Can Recycle Your Garbage. So it's free. It's only 5 pages, okay? So you don't have to say, oh, I'll get around to reading that sometime. It's like, no, you can sit down and read it right now and read the whole thing and get the gist of how to set up and maintain a small worm bin. I mean, my website can keep you busy for days because there's so many categories, you know, so there's small-scale composting and large-scale composting and then small-scale vermicomposting. So it says 4 households, and then I have another category, 4 schools, because I have a curriculum there, vermicomposting curriculum, that can be adapted for any age from preschool to senior high. And then I've got 4 businesses, farms, municipalities, and institutions. And that has the most information on it because, you know, again, people from all over the world are asking for that. So I've got a publication called Raising Earthworms Successfully. My book covers that information more in depth.
And I got to tell you, folks, Rhonda Sherman knows what she's talking about, and she has a new book out called The Worm Farmer's Handbook. You can get all kinds of information from that. It's from Chelsea Green Publishing. And before we go, I would like to mention your annual vermiculture conference. When is that coming up again? Because I hear it's spectacular. Everybody that I've ever talked to about worms who does has been there or read all about the stuff that you do there. So it's a worthwhile event. When will that next one be?
The next one will be in the fall. It'll be the 20th annual.
Oh, cool. Congratulations.
It'll either be October or November. I haven't nailed down the date exactly yet. And I've been going all over the world giving seminars and workshops, and so, you know, I have to kind of work this around it. But it's a 2-day event. People in 34 countries have attended over the years and all over the United States. But it's the only thing. It's the only annual conference on mid to large scale vermicomposting. And so people love coming to it. It's so important to come to it. Some people say, oh, well, don't you videotape it? And we don't really have the means of doing that, but you would miss out because so much of it is, it's not just listening to the speakers. It's being able to network with other people to see what other people are doing, you know, because there's so many ways of going about vermicomposting that you really have to figure out what works for you. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, you're going to meet some people at the conference who are doing things on a scale that you haven't heard about, you know?
Sure.
So,
and made
really
mistakes,
beautiful.
Right? And made the mistakes,
yes,
that you shouldn't make.
Yes. You know, people will say, oh, I can't afford to come. And it's like, you can't afford not to come because otherwise you're going to embark on whatever. You're going to think, oh, I'll do it this way. And then you find out that it costs you more money in the long run because it's not an effective way of doing it.
Cool.
So this is just really the best. I mean, I can talk till I'm blue in the face, but it's nothing like having other people who are doing it from all over the world show you how they're doing it. And, you know, so you get inspired by it. And then you have that support because you've actually met Joe Smith, and you,
yep,
can just call or email him to get more information.
Right.
So
very cool.
Yeah.
Well, Rhonda Sherman, thank you so much for coming on Digging in the Dirt for the second time. We may get you back here another time, but this is really great information. I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, good luck with the new book. It's really spectacular. If people need to feel that they want to get into this in a larger scale than just the basement, or even if it's just the basement, this is a good place to start. The Worm Farmer's Handbook by Rhonda Sherman. Thank you very much.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.